The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are in the second city, Birmingham. Home turf for Daniel Freiber.
It's a home fixture for Daniel.
You have to revert to my English pronunciation. The English pronunciation of my name.
Daniel Freib. home match for Daniel Freib.
And Vic Bennett and yours truly. Not quite home to yours truly.
Which other famous cyclist come from Birmingham?
That's a very good question. I hadn't had a chance to
research that.
I'm too busy alienating great chunks of Great Britain week by week. There'll be very little of it that I'll be allowed to go to soon.
We've already had a disappointing start.
Dan Martin.
We've already had a disappointing start to the morning when Daniel refused to honour our coffee order.
We wanted a flat white and he's got us two lattes.
Because he refused to...
I wouldn't utter those words.
Extraordinary.
Okay, lots to talk about on the cycling front. Lionel, can we have your news roundup, please?
Well, we can. It's a bumper this week, chaps, because there's been so much racing going on and a few things happening off the bike as well. I'll run through the racing as quickly as I can. Start with the Tour of Catalonia in Spain. Already running off the rails here. That's a point of political contention at the moment, isn't it?
But certainly close to Spain.
What is not in doubt is that Alejandro Valverde has won another World Tour stage race. In fact, he's won three stage races that he's done this year, Valenciana, Abu Dhabi, and now Catalonia. Won Catalonia for the second year in a row. Going into the final day in Barcelona, he led Sky's Colombian sensation, can we call him that? Egan Bernal by 16 seconds, but Bernal had a really bad crash on a descent as the stage was coming to a close, and he unfortunately didn't finish the race. Yet to hear exactly how he is, but that meant that Nairo Quintana moved up to second place, making it a Movistar 1-2. Pierre Latour held on to third place by the skin of his teeth after Simon Yates won the final stage. Marc Soler was fifth. He recently won Paris-Nice, didn't he? Soler's fifth place made it three Movistar riders in the top five, so they're going really well. Another crash victim there, Adam Yates, crashed out a couple of days before the final stage. He's fractured his pelvis, so will be off the bike for a little while. The other stage winners included Thomas de Gendt, Harlinson Pantano, and Max Schachmann of Quickstep. Well, it's been a sensational week for Quickstep. Elia Viviani won the 1 day, 3 days of Dapana race. That race has been reduced to 1 day this year. Nicky Terpstra and Philippe Gilbert completed a 1-2 at the Grand Prix E3 Harrebecca. Defending champion Greg Van Avermaet were third there. But on Sunday, Viviani was a distraught figure because he finished second in Gent-Wevelgem when it seemed like it was all there for him. Quickstep had looked so good. We'll talk about these Belgian races in the first part of today's episode, but no one had any answer for Peter Sagan's sprint. It was the world champion's third Gent-Wevelgem win, and that ties the record. Viviani second and Arnaud Démare third, as he was at Milan-San Remo a week ago. In Italy, at the Settimana Coppi e Bartali, Team Sky had a very good week. Diego Rosa won overall ahead of Bauke Mollema. Sky won the team time trial, and Chris Lawless took his biggest win so far. It's his first year as a professional with the team. In the Women's World Tour, the 1 day, 3 days of Dapana was won by Jolien de Hoor ahead of Chloe Hosking and Christine Majerus. And in Gent-Wevelgem, the former world champion Marta Bastianelli edged out de Hoor in the sprint. Britain's Hannah Barnes was sixth there. Off the bike, a bit of news to update on. The Chris Froome latest, this continues to rumble on. Looks like he is going to build up to the Giro d'Italia and start as planned. ASO were said to be considering a move to bar Froome from the Tour if the UCI had not ruled on the salbutamol adverse analytical finding before July, but ASO have denied that, so we are really in limbo as to what Froome's plans will be for the summer. Meanwhile, the UCI has unveiled a new trailer to X-ray bikes looking for hidden motors, so that will be appearing at races from now on. Some more injury news. Scott Thwaites has had a bad crash in training. We don't know an awful lot about this, but the Dimension Data riders had an operation, fractured his vertebrae in that crash. His teammate Mark Cavendish has announced that he won't be riding the Commonwealth Games for the Isle of Man. And finally, the teams were announced for the Tour de Yorkshire. And the bone of contention here is that the Wiggins team has been left out for a second year in a row. Rich, I think you've got a little bit more on that decision.
Well, according to the organisers, there were 60 teams applied for 40 slots. That's across the men's and women's races, so very competitive. The feeling seemed to be that the domestic teams that have been picked have, in the last couple of years, shown themselves very well. It would have been hard to leave any of them out. They've animated the race. And it was felt that Wiggins, when they rode the race, didn't really animate the race. And famously, a couple of years ago, Bradley Wiggins climbed off when the course went reasonably close to his house.
Yeah, it wasn't just the fact that he climbed off, was it? It was the fact he climbed off with 26 kilometres of the opening stage to go, having been one of the marquee riders on the start list.
By happy coincidence, at a very convenient point of the route to get back home.
Mm. Someone's not listening to what I'm saying, are they? Because I just said that about
sorry,
a minute.
Sorry.
Daniel's in his own world.
He is. He's on his home turf in his own world.
The Wiggins is a development team. I mean, the team gets an awful lot of attention intentionally because of the name. But clearly Bradley Wiggins is retired and he wouldn't be riding, so it's a development team. Tom Pidcock is their big rider, I suppose, for the future. There's a very good chance he'll ride the race anyway for Great Britain.
Yeah, I suppose the issue here is that the Holdsworth team, which is a very famous name in the world of cycling from way back when, a team in the 50s and early 60s, I think, but one of the great British brands of yore. They're of a similar level, I guess, but have a strong Yorkshire heritage. And I suppose the unspoken thing, the thing that ASO and the Tour de Yorkshire will not probably say, is that, you know, there is a question mark over the whole Wiggins brand at the moment, isn't there, with everything that's been going on with Wiggins and his TUEs and Team Sky. And although they probably would never be drawn on that, that's bound to have a bearing, I would have thought.
They've got Tom Pidcock, who's a very good rider, but he'll probably be right.
Is that deliberate?
Yes, it was.
Oh, excellent.
Anyway, in this episode, we're talking Cobble Classics, E3 and Gent Wevelgem, and we'll also be hearing from Hannah Troop, who has been out at the Tour of Catalonia for us.
Our Lady in the Desert, yeah. She's got lots of interviews from Catalonia, including with Ali Hodge, the star of last week's episode, a Scotsman.
On the march with Ali's Army. We should be playing a little clip of Ali's Army, really,
well,
shouldn't we?
Well, we'll hear from him. With his wonderful Scottish accent in part two, I think.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our title sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful for their continuing support. And a little mention of some new Rafa travel trips, very exciting new destinations they've just announced for this year. They are taking in Georgia, Kenya, Nicaragua, Patagonia and Tasmania. Some very interesting off the beaten track places with lots of gravel and adventure riding in the mix. Go to rafa.cc/travel for more information. They've got over 60 trips live and ready to book across Europe and the USA. Strapline for their trips. There's a whole world out there, and these new destinations sound very, very interesting indeed. So back to the racing, the Cobble Classics. There have been a few of them, sort of curtain raisers to the big ones. The Tour of Flanders coming up. We'll look ahead to that in part three. But I know you were glued to your sets for E3 and Gent-Wevelgem. What did you think of those races, Daniel?
Intrigued to see a quick step continue there. Well, the fantastic vein of form that they're on collectively. I think the Terpstra's win at the weekend was something like their fifth or sixth race in a row that they'd won among the sort of Belgian semi-classics. And Terpstra's an interesting one. As I said a few weeks ago, he can't really finish. He's not really a race winner. Yeah, that was proven not to be the case, fairly spectacularly. Terpstra is interesting in the sense that I thought he was a candidate to be guillotined by Quickstep when they needed to cull some of the talent that they had. I think it was at the end of last year, they had a lot of riders up for renewal, contract renewal, a lot of very expensive riders who'd boosted their value over the previous couple of years. And he was one of the guys they chose to to renew the contract of. That decision's obviously been vindicated, hasn't it? And what they've done is they've really replaced the sort of one up front, the lone striker model, with this glut of potential race winners, a glut of midfielders. It's a sort of tiki-taka Guardiola type tactic that they're employing now, isn't it? Where really you've got four big hitters, but none of them are necessarily the guy that, you know, everyone is going to be watching in the same way that Sagan is or Van Avermaet is, and that makes it very, very difficult to defend. You know, whenever Lampert goes up the road, then alarm bells are going to ring. Terpstra is the same, Stieber is the same, and Gilbert is the same. And, you know, looking ahead to the Tour of Flanders, we'll talk about this later, but that presents a real problem because there is no equivalent of that in the other teams. And you really have to, I mean, thinking about the tactics ahead of the Tour of Flanders, teams almost have to, well, they have to look at what other teams are doing. They almost have to try to mirror what Quickstep are doing and cancel out each of those four individuals, for example. But it didn't work in Harabeka, did it?
No, it didn't. We'll talk about Harabeka maybe in a minute. But the thing that was interesting was that Quickstep took it on from so far out, 70-odd kilometres to go, and Terpstra and Yves Lampaert were away together. And they had, obviously, Philippe Gilbert and Zdeněk Stybar behind marking. They had those strengths in numbers, but they used them very smartly. And the classic season is always about whether or not Quickstep deliver the results. And so although they didn't win on Sunday and make it two from the big two, to win one and come very close to another, I mean, they're obviously looking good for the Tour of Flanders. And you're absolutely right, I think, Daniel, in that Tom Boonen not being there, it means that they can be a bit more flexible. They can take different decisions, knowing that if they're going to make the running from that far out in Harabeka, other teams have got to counter that, and nobody else really got to grips with it. And of course, when they did get to grips with it, it was too late. And of course, they still had options. I mean, Gilbert came through and won the bunch sprint basically for second place. So they had it completely tied up with a nice ribbon, and delivered very well.
Well, with Boonen sort of leading the line, their typical tactic was to send one guy off the front with about 40, 50, 60 kilometres to go and put the pressure on the chasing group, wasn't it, the peloton, and to then set up Boonen for the sucker punch. And now they've got, instead of those two options, they've got, many more possibilities than that.
And also the thing about having two riders in that break, you know, they're controlling all of the variables there, Terpstra and Lampaert. The fact that Lampaert started to look a bit weaker on the climbs, you know, those two could talk to one another and be absolutely honest about, you know, who's feeling good, who's feeling less good, and they could play their cards absolutely perfectly. Whereas if it had been a Quickstep rider and a rider from another team, there would have been that hesitation, that cat and mouse, trying to suss each other out, and they wouldn't have committed perhaps as fully. But knowing that it was, you know, they were working with a teammate, they had absolutely everything to gain and nothing to lose. And I think tactically that was pretty smart. When you turn on the TV and see, right, they've got two up the road and two in the group behind, I couldn't see any way that they could really mess that up, and so it proved.
Boonen was a great sort of foil, wasn't he? He was like a Sagan, somebody, you know, that everybody else sort of orbited around. And you did have the impression when Terpstra won Paris-Roubaix that he only won Paris-Roubaix because of Boonen, and same with Stijn de Velder at Tour of Flanders, the 2 years that he won it. It was the presence of Boonen in the group that allowed these guys to go off and win. And the dynamics of the team have changed a bit, but again, on certainly E3, it was the presence of Gilbert and Stibar behind that really meant that the chase never really clicked. You know, Terpstra, his lead was 20, 30 seconds. He was obviously pretty tired, but nobody behind was really prepared to commit. I think mainly because of Gilbert. Mm-hmm. Gilbert's clearly going, and we saw on Gent-Wevelgem as well, Gilbert's really strong at the moment.
Well, yeah, he says he's not as strong as last year, but he certainly looks pretty good, and he looked pretty good at the weekend. But, I mean, the one possible weakness they might have is that among the four guys we're talking about, Terpstra, Stibar, Gilbert and Lampert, if you think about the company they might be in a small group in Flanders, for example, they're not necessarily as quick as Van Avermaet and Sagan. In order to be as quick as those guys, they probably will have needed to be in a position where they haven't done any work, which would have been the case with Gilbert, was the case with Gilbert in E3. But again, that forces them to be very aggressive because they Lampert is probably the quickest of those four, and Terpstra is not slow either. And Gilbert, of course, has won small group sprints. But I think that is the one thing that will worry them looking ahead to Tour of Flanders. They won't want to come into the finish in a four or five man group with the likes of Christoph Van Avermaet and Sagan.
BMC had probably the best chance they had three riders in that chase group. They had Jürgen Rolands, Stefan Kung, and obviously Greg Van Avermaet. I think that just shows that really Van Avermaet possibly didn't have it. I mean, you know, they didn't commit everything to pulling that back because others would have profited. Just a quick word also on Team EF Education First. Sepp van Marke was caught in a crash and they did an absolute power of work to get him back into contention. According to a piece on Velo News, our colleagues Velo News, they closed a 5-minute gap. Now, I mean, probably they did, but I mean, it was certainly a big effort to get Van Marke back into the mix. And he, you know, he tried to kind of finish it off. He made that little move. I'm getting my race mixed up there. He made a little move in Gent-Wevelgem, didn't he? But it was E3 where he got dragged back into contention and up to the front group. But that's how it goes, isn't it? These races do tend to merge.
And I mean, we've managed to not really mention Sagan yet, who won Gent-Wevelgem, lest we forget.
Was his absence really made it easier for Quickstep probably in Harelbeke, and I mean in Gent-Wevelgem we didn't really see him at all, did we?
His team were, you know, Daniel Oss has been a very good signing for his team, but Marcus Burghardt as well did a very good job towards the end of Gent-Wevelgem, closing down a dangerous looking move that had Gilbert in it right towards the end. It was that one moment where Sagan needed some help and Burghardt was there to provide it. The other guy I wanted to mention was Teish Benoot, who obviously won Strade Bianche a few weeks ago and looked incredibly strong at E3. But again, it kind of bears out what we said after Strade Bianche, that Benoot needs the race to be so hard and so selective that he's really the last man standing. And these races are not that. Perhaps the Tour of Flanders will be that, because it can be. Much might depend on the weather. But he needs it to be so incredibly hard. And I think Sepp van Marke is kind of the same. Those guys are very, very strong and always there or thereabouts, but it's just very, very hard to imagine them winning.
Yeah, Van Marke did make that move at the very end of Gent-Wevelgem. I mean, it was an interesting race without being as explosive as in previous years. Sagan made the comment that it was the easiest of his three wins in the sense that the conditions were the most benign. It was relatively still, reasonably warm, certainly warmer than it's been in Belgium over recent weeks. We've been gripped by the cold. And there wasn't quite the sort of fireworks on the Kemmelberg. It was decisive in the sense that that move of sort of 18, 20 riders went away. But it was one where all the sprinters were hiding and waiting for the finish. Viviani cut a really dejected figure afterwards. He's said it was his most disappointing defeat. It was a great opportunity for him to win Gent-Wevelgem. Gilbert did a great bit of work in the final couple of kilometres, chased down the Roompot rider. But I wondered about the other two that had been in there. Lampert was just off the back of that group. But Stibar seemed to be sort of sprinting for himself. It wasn't necessary. I didn't feel like they absolutely committed to Viviani's chances. And perhaps if they had done, the outcome might have been different. But Viviani had chosen to watch Demar, thinking that Demar would be the most likely in the sprint. But Sagan, I mean, it was a phenomenal finish. By the time he had that little bit of daylight, it was game over. There was nobody going to close down that gap and get past him. Really impressive riding.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The siren from Radio Tour, of course, reminds us to tell you that this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Beer 52. We're welcoming back Beer 52, actually, because they had such a good response to their last offer on the podcast. So thank you very much to them, and thanks to all of you who took advantage of that offer.
Who'd have thought that so many of our listeners would be beer lovers? I mean, I know I am.
Who'd have thought it?
I know I am. And if I'm not working at the Classics, I love to sit down in front of the telly with a really good beer. I've got to select the right one for the right race. I generally open a beer with about 40 kilometres to go, and I savour it as the race hops up.
The race hops up? What have you got in mind for the Cobbled Classics then, Lionel? A Belgian beer, I assume?
Well, you might think that, but I'm actually going to go for something Irish from Beer 52. As you know, Sean Kelly never actually won the Tour of Flanders, but he did win Paris-Roubaix twice, and I think that Beer 52's new Irish collection is the perfect match, because you need something distinctive, packed with flavour, but it's got to be smooth to counterbalance those cobbles.
Of course, yes. Where can we get some then, Lionel?
Go to beer52.com/cycling, where they're offering a free box of Irish craft beers this month, but there are only 100 boxes available to listeners of the Cycling Podcast, so you'll need to be quick. Pay £5.95 for postage and receive a mix of dark Irish stouts, hoppy IPAs, exclusively brewed by Beer 52 using Irish ingredients such as Irish oats, Irish coffee and Irish honey.
So that's beer52.com/cycling.
That's right, and if you order now, you should get your selection of beautiful Irish beers that you'll be able to enjoy for the rest of the classic season.
Welcome to everyone to this 2018 edition of the Volta a Catalunya. Please, we are calling the riders in few minutes for the North Pole start. Good luck to everyone.
I'm currently in Matro, which is the start of stage two, and I've currently undertaken a task set by Richard Moore to find out whether Colombian Alvaro Hodeg, who won yesterday's stage, whether his surname has actually Scottish roots or whether he has Scottish ancestry. So this could be interesting. I'm expecting just blank looks, so I'll update on how that goes.
Is possible hacer an entrevista en inglés? Or?
Sí, sí.
Sí, vale. So how are you feeling after yesterday?
I feel really happy because the team really did an impressive job yesterday. They were for me yesterday, and also we will try the sprint for today. And
was it planned from the start that was what you were going to do yesterday?
We knew that about 20k for the finish line was a little climb. Was in the first group after the top, then I was a little bit in the back, but all the team was with me. They did a really good job for putting me in the front, and I only did to sprint.
There's a really good strong sprinting team with you guys this year. How are you feeling being amongst some of the best sprinters?
Always was my dream be here. You saw yesterday what did Jungels, Morkov, all the guys were really, really hard. And this was really, really impressive.
And so I have another question that's going to be a little bit odd. But apparently your name has got Scottish roots to it. Do you have like Scottish family or anything?
I really don't know very good the history, but I think it was my grandpa was from Scotia.
Really? And he moved over to Colombia?
To Colombia, yeah.
Ah, excellent.
Well, that was excellent work, Hannah. Well done. I've been joined now by Hannah Troop remotely. You're still in Barcelona, Hannah, recovering after the Tour of Catalonia. We'll hear all about your trip in a moment or two, but you did very well there to get Scotland's Ali Hodge on the podcast.
I was surprised at how it didn't come as a surprise to him and that I wasn't being set up by you, Mr. Moore.
No, he's very, as we heard there from his broad Glaswegian accent, he's very Scottish. Is he going to ride in the Commonwealth Games?
I doubt it.
moving on. He'll need to learn how to say Scotland first, I think, rather than Escocia. I don't know what part of Scotland he's referring to there.
Maybe you could lend in your Commonwealth Games suit.
Yeah. Hannah, you were at the Tour of Catalonia all week. What took you there? Tell us about the start town, in particular Calella, which is not a place that I'm familiar with.
To say I've lived in Barcelona, or previously I've lived in Barcelona for a year and a half, it wasn't a place that I was particularly familiar with either. But it's kind of one of those really beautiful towns along the Costa de Barcelona, which then moves on to the Costa Brava, and it's just such an amazing coastline. The beaches are really beautiful, there's a lot of sand. I was sat out on my balcony overlooking the beach, waves lapping on the shore, it was really picturesque. And it's one of those places where you literally, like in, a little bit in Barcelona as well, or in Catalonia in general, you have such an amazing range of terrain. So you're looking out onto the sea, and then you turn round and there's mountains and natural parks behind you, which is quite amazing. So the mayoress that we spoke to whilst I was there, she was saying that literally you can walk within half an hour from sea up into the mountains. So it's a really beautiful place.
And it's an interesting time, of course, in Catalonia. We were quite curious to see what would happen at the race. Obviously, the political situation has been pretty volatile there. And Marc Soler, local rider, was one of the contenders, wasn't he? We only send you to nice places, of course, Hannah. You've previously been to the desert for us. Only kind of
it's always beaches, always
temperate
beaches.
Climate, lots of sand. But you did speak to the mayoress. Will we hear a bit from her? Can you introduce her, please?
Yeah, so I spoke to her on the day, the morning of the start of the race, a lady called Monse Candini. And yeah, she had a chat about the area and also about a bit about the current political situation as well. It was a chance to show the different types of activities we have here in the city, and we said to the Volta that it would be a good idea for it to start here. Each year we're working more to model the city around sports and activities. The Volta has a huge media impact, really important, with more than 200 types of media, 163 countries, and in 25 different languages. From a tourism point of view, it's a really unique opportunity. So it generally gives a great opportunity to talk about the different characteristics of our city. Two times a year there is Ironman, then we have table tennis. This year we are the Catalonian city for basketball, and we have handball on the beach. The people who live here think a lot and live their lives in the mentality of sport. It forms a part of our DNA. When the attitude is like this of a city, full of people, it means that there are always a lot of people wandering around the streets. There is a lot of life going on here. Through sport, the city shares a lot of moments together, socialising through the sports they play. It's a small part of the world, but here you can enjoy everything. Firstly, you can be looking out to sea, with a nature park behind you, where you can ride your bike up mountains. So for such a small area, you can do so many activities, but most of all, it's a great location for cycling. I know the people of Catalonia and know that the problem at the moment isn't in Catalonia. The problem that we have lays with the Spanish government. But something that we have shown as a Catalan town is that we do about politics like we do with everything else, with a smile. There have been many protests over the years, but they have always been civil and done with peace. This is part of Catalan DNA, and international parties that come here who know us know that what is being said in the media conflicts with who we are and that it doesn't exist. The situation in this image is bad and something that has happened since October. But from the 1st of October, the charges that were made didn't come from any Catalan people or the attitude from anyone here. But it's right, the soul and the feeling at the moment is sad, really sad. We can't believe that we have people in prison, which is unjust. Creemos en el modelo de deporte,
pero sobre todo la única manera de llegar a este modelo es que... So that was the mayoress of Calella, not a place I said I'm familiar with, but that's where the Tour of Catalonia got underway. Our friend Hodge won stage one, Alejandro Valverde won stage two, and then stage three was another Thomas de Gent special, a long range attack, but he also did exceptionally well to hold off the chasers, really powerful group behind him. I don't know really how he did it, but he did it as he's done so many times, and he won a stage there on his own, as he tends to do. And Hannah, you spoke to him the next morning before stage four, which was sort of the queen stage, wasn't it? He had tired legs, obviously, but let's hear what Thomas de Gent had to say on the morning of stage four. And then you spoke to George Bennett, the New Zealander, at the finish. So let's hear from Thomas de Gent and then George Bennett after a very hard day.
So how are you feeling today anyway?
At the moment, still okay, but I think there will be a fast start, and the long climb will be very hard. So I know the finish from today, and I know how the road will be, and I know I'm going to have difficulties. So we will see how it ends.
What? Just take us through kind of what happened yesterday and what was going through your mind then, because from when did you attack and go solo?
I think 20 kilometers to go, just before 20 kilometers to go. It was the moment to go alone because I was already doing most of the work and the other two guys, they were a bit tired. So if I'm already doing all the work, I can even go alone. So I went solo and then not really for the victory, but just for the mountain points. And you never know where they catch you back. But in the end, it was for the victory. So it was a good decision at that time.
But it was kind of, I mean, the wind yesterday was just insane. It was really windy, wasn't it?
And it was all in the face. There was not really one moment where I could just recover for 5 minutes. It was always wind in the face or uphill, so it was hard, but I think it was also hard for everybody.
And what's your plan now for protecting the leader's jersey?
I'm just going to try and hang on as long as possible, but I know I will drop somewhere on the last climb, maybe the climb before, so I don't have really dreams about overall victory or keeping the jersey, but I will try my best to keep it or try to defend it as long as possible. But I think I will lose it today to somebody who is a better climber than me.
Because, I mean, Movistar are really a bit of a force to reckon with at the moment, aren't they, this week?
Yeah, but they have two guys that can win today on this finish, and even the guys from Orica, they can win also. So there are a lot of really good climbers, and even if I'm better than one of them, there are always 7-8 other guys who will be better than me. So I don't have any dreams for today, but I will try to enjoy my jersey, and we will see.
How was that anyway?
Oh, yeah, that was just a bastard of a day. I was not having a good day. Me and Yatesy were putting in big turns, but obviously Movistar was sitting on and Hugh Carthy wasn't really giving it everything. I think he might have just been gassed because we jumped across really early on the climb and then they caught us and then it was just struggle street the whole way up. Oh, I was so bloody cold. I've just come out of New Zealand, it's 30 degrees, -4 up the top there. So I was in trouble with the cold. Already yesterday, I really suffered, and I said to Stevie at the bottom, I said, I just work for you. And then they went, and I saw that everyone else has been suffering as well, and they all blew up, so I just kept going.
And so I've been told that, what are your plans for the year? Are you looking to do the Giro this year?
Yeah.
How are you feeling going into that? Because obviously it's not too far out.
Yeah. I felt really good in Torino. I don't feel that good here. I think that's just because I'm so bloody cold. I'm going to take a week off now, after Sunday hopefully, and then a really easy week, go to altitude, train hard, and then go to Alps Tour, and then all for the Giro.
Well, we heard from George Bennett there, as he said he's targeting the Giro this year. Rode a very good race, Catalunya, finished 6th overall, pretty consistent. He was 8th on that Queen's stage. It sounded extremely cold there, Hannah.
Yeah, my smugness of being sat in a t-shirt on a balcony at the start of the race quickly deteriorated once I got up to the top of La Molina, which is in the Pyrenees, because it was freezing. It was about -4 degrees up at the top of that mountain. So yeah, when I spoke to George Bennett, he had said just how cold it was.
But obviously going well. Now you, a team that had a kind of mixed fortunes over the week were Mitchelton, Scott, Esteban Chavez continues to struggle, it looks like. And Adam Yates had a nasty crash and looked to have really seriously injured himself. But you spoke to their sports director, David McPartland, who had perhaps a slightly different verdict on the damage to Adam Yates and when he'll be back on the bike. Let's hear from him now. Here's David McPartland.
How's it been this week? Because, I mean, obviously, you've obviously had Adam sort of take the bit of a tumble earlier in the week, and then obviously it's been left down to Simon as well. I mean, obviously with the team, but it's been a tough race as far as Movistar has really pushed it, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Hats off to them. You know, the way they rode all week. We came in with probably one of the strong, just a strong team as them on paper, I think, and we just had a bit of misfortune with Adam, and but we bounced back really well. Like, especially today showed that with his brother Simon, and just missed the podium by was actually on countback. I think for the week, considering we've had our time where we've, you know, got on the front to ride to bring groups back to try and have a sprint for Daryl, and we've come up short in that area, you know, just a little bit, and it's been different this year with, I think, 7 riders now, and also here there was not so many sprint teams, so it's made it really complicated. It's been a complicated week, but the way we've ridden, we've been really happy, and we've got the reward today.
And how is Adam doing? Is he going to be back on the bike anytime soon? Obviously, soon.
Yeah, it's probably not as bad as what we initially thought. he has another X-ray in about 10 days' time, and then from there we'll assess how it's developing, and then he could be on the bike within probably from now, maybe 2 weeks. For the next week or so, is non-weight bearing. So we'll see in another couple of weeks.
So that was David McPartland from Mitchelton Scott, and I was quite interested to hear that, the damage to Adam Yates perhaps isn't as bad as they initially thought, and that he could be back on his bike in 2 weeks, which could mean that his season isn't as disrupted as we feared. And I know the Tour de France is on his schedule, that may still be on. Now, Hannah, one of the other things you wanted to do all week was interview Alejandro Valverde, but it didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't. But actually, so just going back to Adam Yates, actually, I spoke to his physio at the end of the race, one of the guys who works with him quite regularly, and he was saying that although it was a fractured pelvis, it's a stable fracture. So he said that he's in a bit of pain, but yeah, he'll be back on the bike really soon, and they don't see much disruption. So that's good to hear anyway.
And Valverde, I mean, it didn't help that he was leading the race for quite a long time, but they kind of kept him hidden away, didn't they, a little bit?
Yeah, I think because Movistar had gone into the week, obviously they had a really strong team and they kept the pressure on the whole week, and all of the rest of the teams, they definitely felt that. But I think Movistar were being particularly protective of Valverde, obviously, but also as well of Soler and Quintana. So it felt like there wasn't that much interaction with the team over the week, which was a bit of a shame, especially because Soler is obviously done really well this year with Paris-Nice, so it would have been quite interesting to have got a bit more from him, but and especially from Valverde as well.
Any other notes from the week, Hannah? Anything else that caught your eye?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, all of the riders that I spoke to over the week were saying how tough a course it really is, and especially not only just the weather with snow, with the high winds and everything like that, but also the fact that there was no TT this year means that it's kind of really full on every single day. So that was something that a lot of them sort of fed back. And then the other thing to say was really in that, when it comes into Barcelona, that final circuit, those laps of Montjuïc, I mean, it's a really tough course to finish on. And on the day, it just started to rain slightly when they were coming in, so the road was so slippy. And I was speaking to David Partland as well, and he was saying that on that corner where Bernal and Rojas and Martin had the crash, obviously he was saying that people were going around that corner around about 70 kilometres per hour. So hitting the deck, it's no wonder that Bernal has now come out of it. Sky has released a statement saying that he's suffered multiple fractures to his collarbone and shoulder blade. So it sounds like he's really suffered from that. And you could see when he went down, it was a really heavy, heavy crash. But yeah, apart from that, it's a really tough race. And it was an interesting one to see. And also the fact that so many riders were very happy with how quickly the organisation made weather protocol calls so early in the morning, so by shortening stages or taking out some at finishes. So again, the organisation of it seemed really, really sort of like on point, which is good to see.
You mentioned Dan Martin there, and we'll actually hear from him in a moment. He's had a disappointing start to the year with his new team, UAE Emirates. And was involved in that crash, unfortunately. We'll hear a little bit from him from earlier in the week about his early impressions with the team. I thought I mentioned Thibaut Pinot. I thought rode a good aggressive race, and just behind him, David Godu, his young teammate at Groupama FDJ. They've been riding very well in Northern Europe with Arno Demar, with a group there at the Cobble Classics, and their stage races are obviously coming nicely to the boil as well. But I mentioned Dan Martin, you spoke to him earlier in the week. Let's hear a little bit from him now.
Dan, how's things going so far in UAE?
Obviously it's been less than ideal with getting sick in Paris-Nice, but yeah, my condition was really good and I've really fitted well into the team, so that's the benefit, both, that's the best part, you know. So that's the atmosphere is great and we're racing with a smile on our face, but the results obviously aren't what we'd hoped for so far, but yeah, I mean, training and everything's gone to plan, just that little sickness in Paris and he set me back, so yeah, it's a bit, I'm anxious to see how good I am this week. The official language is English, and in the radio speak English and all the staff now speak English. So it's definitely a team in transition, obviously, from the Italian roots to what it's becoming, which is like, I was aiming to be one of the best teams in the world. So yeah, I'm playing a bigger role in that than I foresaw before I came here, obviously helping them progress and bringing my experience from other teams into the equation to try and improve it, the team, in every manner, not just like, so yeah, it's definitely a team in that's building, and but yeah, the history and the Italian connection is obviously invaluable too.
So that was Dan Martin not won't be very happy with, you know, the way that his race ended, and obviously it's all about the Tour de France for him this year, but he's not had a great start to the year, a lot of bad luck. There was a good stage win for Harlison Pantano. Trek Segafredo had a great start to the season. Hannah, you spoke to his teammate Peter Stettina, I think, who sort of looked back on the week.
Yeah, so he kind of gave a bit more of an insight into how tough the race was. He looked pretty beat by the end of the, when I saw him on the after the final stage. And it was quite an interesting story about Pantano dedicating the win to their teammate Markel Izizar, who really tragically, the day before they raced through the area where Pantano won, he lost his cousin in an avalanche. So that was quite a horrific event for the team and for Markel to have to go through and race on. So, yeah, it meant a lot to them that day for sure.
Typical Catalonia, cold weather and no time trial means just long road stages every day, and it ends up actually being one of the biggest workload weeks of the year, similar to the third week of the Giro or the Tour. So it's hard in the spring, especially with the cold weather.
Yeah. Are you based in here in Catalonia then?
Yeah, I'm based in California, but I've been in and out of Girona for over 10 years now. One of the original guys there, yeah.
And so how was it yesterday, the day before for Jørgensen? How was that amongst the team?
Oh, that was great. That was our saving grace of the week, because we just tried to be aggressive every day and go for the breakaway, and it was kind of a lottery on a lot of these days, and we just made sure we always had a guy in everything, and that day ended up being two of us, and Laurent Didier committed fully for Jørgensen, and I mean, Jørgensen can go downhill like a kamikaze, and he held it. So, I mean, that was a nice pick-me-up for the team after a rough February. So,
and I understand that he would kind of dedicated the win, and it was quite a special win for him, wasn't it?
Yeah. Actually, on that Tunnel de Vieja, Markel Irizar's cousin had died in an avalanche the night before. So it was kind of... It was a little tough, especially for Markel racing through there the next day. It was just one of those freak accidents, but it meant a lot to Markel for us to bring home the flowers to his family.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science of Sport for their support. And a reminder, you can get 25% off all your Science of Sport products with the code SISCP25. SISCP25. You enter that at the checkout at scienceandsport.com. And keep your questions coming for their experts. I think it's next week I'm actually meeting them. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. Any sports nutrition questions, either relating to yourself or the pros, send them in and we'll put them to them, and we'll hear the answers to those throughout the year. So we heard from Hannah Troop in the Tour of Catalonia last week. She was there, and a few of the interviews that she gathered, including Ali Hodge, our Scottish quick step sprinter. Any thoughts on the Tour of Catalonia, chaps? Anything to add? It was Valverde. Where do you start with Valverde?
Where do you end? Where does he end?
Where does he end? Tokyo, apparently. Tokyo Olympics. He wants to win the Tokyo Olympic road race.
But then would he not carry on? He'll be 40 then.
Yeah, he'll be 40 that year, yeah.
Blimey. Yeah.
Davide Rebellin is 47 this year, still riding.
But I think if you have a two-year rest, then obviously it adds a...
Two-year sabbatical, as David Moncoutier used to call them.
Yeah. Come back recharged, so to speak.
Loaded. Innuendo here, but
yeah,
I mean,
the trouble here is it's kind of difficult to get excited about another Valverde win, isn't it? Are we not giving him the respect that he deserves?
Also difficult not to be very hypocritical, because we've got excited about other riders in the past who have had bans,
mm-hmm.
And treated them fairly, sort of.
But I think there's two things going on here. There is the history, but there's also just the consistency, the boring consistency of Valverde. He's always good, and he's always up there. And you know, I suppose a lot of fans have a certain view of him. Some people love him. Among the riders, he seems to be a very respected figure.
And it's interesting, again, I think we mentioned last week or a couple of weeks ago, just thinking about this trio of riders that Movistar are still stubbornly saying that they're going to take to the Tour de France as an attacking trident: Valverde, Quintana, and Landa. Quintana was third in Catalunya, wasn't he? Second. When Bernal crashed out on the last stage. We can quibble with that choice, and we have quibbled with it. But then on the other hand, you've got a rider like Marc Soler, who won Paris-Nice and looked very strong again in Catalunya. And you know, they're going to use him at the Vuelta, and they've got other options at the Giro. So, you know, who knows? They might prove us wrong. I think that their problem, Movistar's problem in the past, has been not knowing necessarily how to deploy their strength in numbers and not attacking in the right places. But, you know, maybe they'll get it right this year.
Tour of Flanders, can we speculate on that? That's coming out very soon.
We can.
Are we
rolling straight into the Tour of Flanders?
Tour of Flanders, absolutely, yeah. Straight from Catalonia to Flanders.
Should I say what the bookmakers are saying? One bookmaker, Mr. William Hill, turf accountant, very respected turf accountant. He has Peter Sagan as favourite, followed by 11-4, followed by Gilbert, 5-1, Van Avermaet, 5-1. Kwiatkowski, who's had a pretty quiet classic season so far, 9-1. Terpstra, Benoit, Trentin, Stibar, Sepp van Marck, 16-1. Narsen has been impressive. He's looked impressive at times, but he looks a bit isolated to me. Again, if we think that this is going to be a theme, as it has been in the semi-classic so far, that the strength in numbers of Quickstep, then a guy on his own like Narsen, or with limited support in the sort of last 50 kilometers of a race like the Tour of Flanders, might struggle.
I mean, you mentioned Kwiatkowski. Sky have had a disappointing run of it so far in the classics. Moscon has looked like he's going pretty well. Kwiatkowski should come in. Ian Stannard has been pretty invisible so far, but they should have we were talking before we started recording, you know, there are other teams with riders who on paper look as good as Quickstep's assortment of riders, and yet none of them seem to be able to do what Quickstep do.
Well, just on Sky and Moscon, just looking back at Genwevergem on Sunday,
he was pushing the barriers, wasn't he?
He was. Christophe Laporte closed the door on Gianni Moscon on the Kemmelberg. Just looked like one of those. To me, it looked like Laporte was just getting out of the saddle a little bit and moving across, and Moscon was trying to cut up the inside on the right hand side, and literally the door was closed in his face, and that was really race over for him from that point on. Finished 45th, but Sky do have the numbers. But Daniel, you know, talking about Quickstep and just the knowledge and know-how of the roads, it's so important in the Tour of Flanders. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but you take the wrong line round a corner, or you're too far back going into one of the early hills, and you can pay for that later on. You may not even realise at the time that the race has slipped away, because when the gaps start opening up on the later climbs, those gaps become harder and harder to close. It's going to be quick steps to lose, I would imagine, in terms of numbers. But if you know, that, who knows what is going to happen? That's the beauty.
Who knows what's going to happen?
The beauty of the Tour of Flanders, isn't it? I mean, all of the clues that we've garnered from these races, and literally anything can happen, and that's the beauty of watching it, isn't it?
Yeah, and we talk about Quickstep and the knowledge they have of the roads. I mean, I think that's one of a very wide constellation of factors which make them as good as they are. I think they're the only team, really, that doesn't have, at the start of the season, pretty much a 10-ride or 11-ride long list for the Tour of Flanders. And 10 or 11 guys who know that their place is guaranteed in the Tour of Flanders. There are probably 17 guys or 16 guys on the Quickstep roster who are fighting for their place in the Tour of Flanders from January. I mean, I remember, I think it was 4 years ago, the 3 days of Dapana, which was a sort of last audition, it used to be, for Quickstep. Guillaume van Kersbroek won the race. And I remember him coming into his winner's press conference, and the mood also kind of among the Belgian press and the Belgian journalists was such that, you know, it was as though van Kersbroek had won a world championship, not because he'd won the 3 days of Dapana, but because he'd won the last place in Quickstep's team. And obviously, you know, that internal competition, I think, is a really powerful force in terms of just getting riders into their best possible condition. And, you know, I think that should never really be underestimated. And again, going back to the way they've structured their team this year, they did have all of those riders coming to the end of their contracts. They had a lot of difficult choices to make, Lefebvre. And, you know, if you looked at the balance of the team, most teams in that situation would have said, right, we'll take a bit away from our classics department and we'll put it into other areas because, you know, the budget is tight. But what did they do? They pretty much retained all of their ride, all of their classic specialists, apart from Trentin, who left. And yeah, they've reinvested in that. And that, I think, that just underlines how this race means more than anything else for that team.
Just, I mean, Trentin is another dark horse, you know, but again, he's looked isolated. And you know, there are strong, Oliver Nasson's another one, there are strong individuals who you're very aware of and you see them, but they are kind of limited in what they can do because they don't have the support. On the subject of speculation, you mentioned, you know, 17, 18 riders could win it. None of us predicted Philippe Gilbert last year, as we were reminded recently. None of us mentioned Vincenzo Nibali in our predictions for Milan-San Remo. We had a good tweet, actually, from Kelly Milligan on the subject. Cycling is like the weather. You can make educated guesses based on previous patterns, but they will continue to be guesses.
Well, that's exactly right, isn't it? And I think an awful lot of, I mean, it's fun to speculate about what might happen, but also kind of pointless, isn't it? I mean, we've all written articles looking
ahead. What are we doing?
Well,
here in Birmingham.
Well, exactly. Well, let's just kill it here. That's it.
Okay. See you next week.
But the thing is that it's about learning, you know, what happens in previous years. And I mean, obviously, last year's race hinged on Gilbert's move and hinged on, you know, an accident, you know, that took out Sagan, Van Avermaet, and Oliver Nasson, who were looking absolutely fantastic at that time and had things just about under control at that point. But that was on the older Quaremont. Sagan caught a bag or a jacket, wasn't it? And that was the moment of the race. And but Gilbert had already gone. No one will be letting Quickstep riders too far off the leash, you would imagine. I think that, you know, Greg Van Avermaet has not looked as good this spring as last. But sometimes, you know, being not the strongest and not the most watched is actually an advantage.
That's why Sagan doesn't win as many races as he should, because he's often the strongest rider in the race, and being the strongest rider in the race can be a handicap in trying to win that race. And you say that, you know, teams know that they can't let, you know, two Quickstep riders up the road, but they know that going into the race. They knew that on Friday before E3. They knew that they shouldn't let two Quickstep riders up the race with 70k to go, but it happens. They all must go into the race with similar plans. You know, BMC must go in with a similar sort of plan.
You would, yeah. But on Sagan, I mean, that's why Gent Wevelgem worked out so perfectly for him, because he could afford to just sit and do nothing. It didn't actually matter so much if he won or lost that race. And you know, he's won it twice before, had nothing to lose by just sitting in there and letting it all happen around him. And he's, you know, in a sort of way, he's got that luxury again on Sunday, although because it's the Tour of Flanders, everyone will want to, you know, they won't want to sandbag their way to the finish and hope for the best. It's a race where you do get rewarded for taking it on. But I think BMC, you know, they have got the resources to at least go head to head with Quickstep, and I think that will be the interesting thing. And then it will, like you say, it will be about the lone wolves, the freelancers, to see what they can do off the back of other teams' efforts.
And we shouldn't forget as well that the Tour of Flanders is 60 kilometres longer, or 60, 70 kilometres longer than some of the semi-classics we've seen so far. And you know, very often it is that the survival of the fittest and the strongest guy does win, but it's also often a question of riders deciding who to take over the river with them. And you know, is the guy I take over the river with me going to eat me? And that's it's essentially about estimating and trying to size up how much people have got left. Is this guy faster than me? Has he got more juice left in his legs than me? And sometimes you get those calculations wrong. And you know, a rider like Lampert, who I mentioned earlier on, you know, we think and probably the riders in the race, they think they've got a rough idea of how fast a guy like that is, but sometimes they get it wrong because we don't have a sample size of 200 sprints of Yves Lampert versus Greg Van Avermaet after 250 kilometres. So, you know, it's a guessing game.
A very good analogy, that. How do you get Peter Sagan, Greg Van Avermaet and a bag of grain across the river?
Okay, if it's terrible weather, snow, ice, five men finish, I think Tesh Benoit will win. If it's a sunny day, Jasper Stuyven is my. I think he's got a good big result in him. He looks good. John Degenkolb, his teammate Trek Segafredo, still doesn't look like he's returned to the form.
Yeah,
that
very
he has.
Interesting story. The Degenkolb one. Mm. There was an interesting piece on Cycling News. Sorry to mention a rival medium. That's okay, isn't it? We can do that today. There seems to be that it's obviously a touchy subject around Trek. How Degenkolb is going, whether he's fully recovered from the accident. It's 2 years ago now, wasn't it? The terrible accident that the team that was then Giant Alpecin had in training in Spain. Obviously, he suffered terrible damage to one of his hands, had multiple operations on one of his fingers, and has never quite rescaled the heights that he had attained before the accident. He's saying that it's not having any effect on his riding anymore. Dirk de Mol, one of the direct sportifs at Trek Segafredo, sort of contradicted that. He said he's not quite back to where he was, but certainly results-wise, he hasn't been quite the Degenkolb of old.
Before we wind this up, we ought to hear from our colleague Edward Pickering. It's the Tour of Flanders on Sunday, and he's written a book all about the race, Ronda, out now. And Richard, you caught up with him to ask him what five things he learned about the Tour of Flanders in the process of writing and researching that book.
I've got my list of five things, and I think these cover both racing and non-racing aspects, but that's what makes the Tour of Flanders so interesting. First of all, possibly a contentious statement, but I'm willing to back this up with arguing. I think it's the hardest race to win of the major bike races. They're obviously all hard to win, but I think the Tour of Flanders is the most complicated race, especially the monuments to master, and it takes such a broad range of skills to do well. Being strong in the Tour of Flanders is only the entry criteria. You need to have local knowledge because the route is so complex. It twists and turns left, right, up, down, north, south, east, west. 1 minute riders could be heading north, and then two 90 degree bends, and 5 minutes later they're heading south, which means the wind, which was coming from the left, is now coming from the right. The roads are narrow, and Flanders specialises in these kind of climbs that don't have descents immediately. So distance is obviously huge. It's a monument. It's 260, 270 kilometres. You need kind of luck as well. You need so many different assets, and everything has to fit into place so perfectly. It makes it a really hard race to win. Second thing I learned, more of a surprise to me this, but the cycling stereotype of Flanders both is and isn't accurate. You know, the iconography of the Tour of Flanders and the way it's kind of marketed and presented to us, especially in the modern era, is it plays up to its traditional roots. It's heroic, but it's heroic in a way that suggests kind of perseverance and toughness, which is a very kind of Flemish stereotype, and it's very different from the iconography of the Tour de France, which is very colourful and kind of glamorous and spectacular. Even though they both share the kind of physical toughness, there's very different iconography between the two events. The next thing I realised, to understand the Ronde, you need to know what Flanders is. By reputation, the true Flandrians, in inverted commas, are those who come from East and West Flanders. Even then, East Flandrians aren't quite Flandrian enough for West Flandrians, so it's quite complex. There's obviously a binary division between Flanders and Wallonia, which is linguistic, but there's also things that unify them. And what unites them at the base is religious history, and Flanders and Wallonia have kind of seesawed between influence and prosperity. So the Tour of Flanders, like the Tour de France, was invented to sell newspapers. It was invented by a journalist, but it was also quite an overt statement of Flemish cultural pride at a time when the Flemish were relatively oppressed by the Wallonian half of the country. The Tour of Flanders was not only a bike race, it's always been one of the cultural touchstones of Flemish identity. It's an incredibly important part of the race. The next part is related to my statement that it's the biggest, it's the best bike race in the world, because this is the richest race in the world. And I don't mean financially, I mean in terms of how complex it is. We already know that bike racing is richer than just being a case of having a winner, even though you can understand it on that level as well, and that's fine. And beyond the tactics, there's politics. I think on all these levels, the Tour of Flanders works extremely well. There's also geography. Bike racing is, you know, it's inseparable from whichever region it takes place in. And in Flanders, that's key, just because of the complexity of the route and the, you know, the repetition of the climbs, specifically in the Tour of Flanders, makes the geography so, and the kind of backdrop so important to the race. There's weather, which affects bike races, and again, with the Tour of Flanders, because the race tends to loop north and south, and the prevailing wind comes from the west, it means there's, you know, the wind comes from so many different angles, which is an aspect you've got to master to win the Tour of Flanders. On all the levels I've just described, the Tour of Flanders is incredibly rich on every level. It draws me in. Lastly, on a more kind of nerdy racing level, I think a certain kind of rider wins the Tour of Flanders. The cobbled hills that you tend to encounter in the Tour of Flanders demand quite a specific physical type. When you're climbing on cobbles, the cobbles make the wheels slip more than, or the back wheels slip more than climbing on tarmac. So a rider's weight needs to be relatively far back. Basically, you have to climb sitting down in the Tour of Flanders, otherwise it doesn't work. That ability to put out huge seated power is the biggest asset you can have in the Tour of Flanders.
So that was Ed Pickering. He's spent a lot of time studying the Tour of Flanders. Obviously, we'll all be watching it with great interest on Sunday and talking about the result next week.
Yeah, I don't want to embarrass Ed here because he does mention this in the book, but he wasn't really that into the Tour of Flanders until we went on a trip to go and see it. I think he saw it as a kind of the poor relation of the Spring Classics, perhaps a product of the kind of same generation where the Tour de France riders used to ride Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and that seemed to be the big, most prestigious one. And you know, the Tour of Flanders was kind of the grubby, cobbly,
I don't want to be sacrilegious, but I don't love the Tour of Flanders as much as a lot of other people seem to, especially on the new circuit.
The new circuit has taken it's taken me a while to kind of appreciate, but I do think it's a, you know, it's a great race. It unfolds in stages. It's interesting. It absorbs you as it's unfolding, and you can never quite
Paris-Bay,
be sure.
Milan-San Remo.
Yeah, true.
E3 was a great race. You know, if it's as good a race as E3, then that'll be great. It was good last year. Before we go, I should mention that last week we released our latest Friends special, the Flanders Cycling School. I went to visit Tim Harris and Jocelyn Ryan in East Flanders and met some of the young riders who are living in one of their houses now and trying to turn pro. And the
Tim
episode
Harris, dog, we're dog. Reliably
I thought the
informed.
Chairman would
the
be
chairman
a good
is much better
nickname. Mm. The chairman.
That's but because he's deals in furniture.
He sells
chairs.
Yeah. And he's a former professional rider. And it was his chats with Tim and Jocelyn and some of the young riders who are trying to turn pro. And we'll be following those young riders over the course of the year. So stay tuned for that. To become a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Thank you very much to everybody who has signed up. And thanks for your feedback so far on that episode as well.
Hate to we have a no praise policy on the Cycling Podcast, don't we? We'd never say
I'm not sure it's
nice
a policy
about,
I think it's just a habit,
yeah, just our characters, isn't it? But I've absolutely gripped by listening, particularly at the start, Tim and Jocelyn explaining, you know, how they came to be so pivotal in you know, effectively guardians for these young riders, generations of
it's
young
astonishing
riders.
It's astonishing the number and of riders and the number of names that we all know who've been through there. It's not even a system, but it is a kind of system.
Yeah, but then hearing from the young riders themselves and wondering, you know, who's got it to make it and who hasn't. I mean, it put me in mind of the Netflix documentary Last Chance You about a high school football. Just a similar sort of thing, really, because cycling is a... Well, Daniel, you tweeted something from an Italian under 23 race, I think it was a little video, and it's the sports director,
Luca Shinto, wasn't it?
No, was it not? No.
I didn't watch it. I didn't click on it.
It was a junior race.
It was a junior race, and the riders alongside the team car saying, "Oh, I'm cold," and the sports director basically says, "Well, it's a shitty sport. Get up to the front and make yourself warm." Effectively,
Tim Harris told the young riders a story about, you know, him being in a race in Belgium and his sports director threatening to run him off the road. I don't think that kind of thing goes on nowadays, but he was literally, bumper was millimeters from his bike, saying he was going to run him off the road. But yeah, it's a fascinating look. I was really interested in what Jocelyn said as well about, you know, she mentioned Simon Yates was one of the riders who'd been in their house, and Simon, you know, he's a little slight thing, and he's obviously ridden won mountain stages and races, and you know, we see him as a GC rider, but she was just talking about how good he was in Belgium on those hard races with crosswinds, and she'd say a good rider will ride well in Belgium. It's a myth that you have to be a sort of big muscular ruler to do well in Belgium.
Well, maybe Nibali will win the Tour of Flanders on Sunday.
Wait, Nibali, good, I'm glad you mentioned him.
There we are.
I should also mention this week we've just released the Cycling Podcast Femina, the March episode with myself and Orla Shinawi and Rose Manley. Lots of interviews in that, including Kasia Nivedoma, Alexis Ryan, Alice Barnes, Marion Voss, Gracie Elvin on the Cyclist Alliance, which is the new organisation set up to promote and represent women's cycling. Really interesting organisation that, and lots of chat about the races in there, and the women's tour, look ahead to the women's tour route as well. So that is available now. Finally this week, our rescheduled event in Glasgow will happen on the 11th of April. That's Wednesday, the 11th of April, at the Trades Hall of Glasgow. Beautiful venue in the Merchant City. Tickets are on sale for that now. If you go to the cyclingpodcast.com live events, it'll take you through to the site to buy tickets. So that's Wednesday, the 11th of April, for our Glasgow event. That's all for now, I think. We'll be back next week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube to keep up with all the latest news and special offers from us. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by John Mooney.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7-9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.